What's up, everybody? Welcome to season three. Are we in season three?
We're in season three.
Episode five.
We're in episode five.
Of the Alternative Blacks podcast, otherwise known as the Amaryllis show.
Amaryllis.
So as craft beer enthusiasts, we're all aware of a couple like anchors of the industry, right? We're going to talk about Boston Beer Company. We're going to talk about Sierra Nevada, you know, New Belgium. And then we're going to also look at some of the, I guess I would call them newer pioneers, as like Voodoo, Iron Hill, and their place in the craft beer industry. So on today's episode, I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Chris Kissinger, as always, we aim to highlight the lack of diversity in craft brewers and in the industry, and try to bring more diversity to the industry through our podcast and our Instagram. So make sure that you follow us at Alternative Blacks Podcast on Instagram and subscribe to our Patreon, link in the bio. But let's take a look at the anchors of craft beer. But before we get into any of that,
beer!
That's right.
What we got today, Tyler, because this is all you.
That's true. So it is Other Half's 9th anniversary, which I feel like they've been around for so much longer, I felt. So they had a bunch of different, they had like 9 different collaborations. This one is number 4. It's an IPA. It is collab with Highland Park Brewery and Monkish Brewing Company.
Oh, yes, Monkish.
Yeah, LA is in the house for our 9th anniversary with the IPA hopped with our passion fruit and peach forward galaxy and a new hop, HBC 1019. That has huge peach ring notes. So it's a peach ring beer.
But I didn't know it was HPR. I thought it was HBC.
HBC? What did I say? HPR?
Huge peach ring.
Drink your beer.
It has notes of peach ring, oddly enough. No, but it does have a little sweetness to it. I would actually say peach ring is fairly accurate here.
Oh, yeah.
It's good. It's a hazy IPA because, you know, it's Other Half. So you have that, but it's really good. It's actually different than, I would say, most of Other Half's beer, if that makes sense, even though they're kind of operating in a fairly tight range.
Yeah, I think this has like that very distinct flavor to it that kind of takes it out, where it's like, okay, if you put this in a lineup of other hazy beers and I was meant to take the peach ring one out of that lineup, it would be, I think, fairly easy to pull that out if you did with like other half beers that weren't the peach ring.
Yeah, I would say that. I feel like Other Half uses, I feel like they use a lot of lactose in their beer.
It has that like smoothie creaminess to it, almost.
Yeah, but it's very distinctive, and I feel like a lot of their beers kind of run that flavor profile, and then they just kind of switch out the hops, where this one feels like a little more of its own. It stands on its own as its own thing. So I really like this.
I wonder how much that has to do with the collaboration element of it, you know?
Yeah, who's collaborating on this one?
So that's going to be Highland Park Brewery and Monkish Brewing Company. I know Monkish is out of, like, L.A., I believe.
Oh. And Highland Park?
Brewery. I'm assuming it's Chicago. But no, L.A.
Yeah, Los Angeles. Wait, is Other Half out west?
I don't know how far Other Half actually makes it out yet. I think they're fairly coast.
Yeah, I thought there was like one. There's one like upstate New York, I think.
Yeah, they have some in the Finger Lakes, it looks like.
Finger Lakes.
D.C., yeah, Philly, DC. Couple, New York.
New York.
New York.
New York, New York.
Right, exactly. But they're really, yeah, Buffalo, Philadelphia, D.C., Finger Lakes, Rockefeller Center, Domino Park, Center Street, yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize they had that many locations, actually.
Yeah, and it's every time that they have a, like, interview, they're like, yeah, we don't know if we're, like, I think we're done expanding, and then, like, the next month there's a news article, like, and the other half is expanding into...
Well, that's because they already solidified that deal in their minds. Now they're finished expanding.
That has to be it, but let's say, like... They have what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 locations at the moment. And that's not even the most that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, which is crazy. But I didn't know that. That kind of adds them into kind of what we're going to talk about a little bit here with the new anchors.
So before we get into the conversation, what would you rate this?
Ooh, this is... I feel like a general staple for other half is 4. It's like a straight 4.
If I drop something underneath a 4 from other half...
I didn't like it. There's an issue. This got to be a 4-5. Easy. I'm going to go 4-5.
I'm pretty sure that's what I gave it, was a 4-5. Because I definitely tried all of these yesterday.
I thought you were going to say it's because you have an obsession with peach rings.
I love peach rings.
I know.
They are the best.
You used to have like the industrial gummy bears and the industrial peach rings.
It goes gummy bears?
Yeah.
Peach rings.
Peach rings. 20-pound bag of gummy bears, 10-pound bag of peach rings.
Right, and the 5-pound Twizzlers.
Yeah. You basically had, like, the bulk candy counter glass behind the glass, but it was just, like, in your room, just a setup.
Just take out the little shovel right into the mouth.
Yeah.
Why use the shovel? Just use the hand, really. It was only the... so I could share it with people.
Nature shovel.
Nature shovel?
Yeah, nature shovel. All right, so let's get into kind of introducing our topic here, and we're going to be discussing some of the big names in the early craft beer scene and kind of how they positively and negatively affected the craft beer industry up until today.
Yeah, and so when we think early brewing companies, we're thinking Sierra Nevada, we're thinking Boston Beer Company, New Belgium, you know, those type of names that were there in the beginning and are still kind of around. Kind of around. They are around.
They around. So, yeah, let's talk about Sierra Nevada for a second here. One of the positives is obviously they're one of those original pioneers from the 1980s in the original craft beer movement out of the West/Midwest. And they continue to be a major player even today. Their pale ale is pretty much like a staple classic in a lot of people's fridges.
Oh, definitely. And like when we're doing home brewing, that's one of those beers, like that's one of the first beers that I kind of looked at to try to replicate. And that's widely available. Never under the name, but it's like...
but it's like oddly, it's like, what's that Uncanny Valley? It's kind of like the Uncanny Valley of beer names.
Right, exactly. It's like Sierra's...
Sierra Las Vegas.
Right. Well,
but Sierra Colorado.
But Sierra Nevada also has like a really strong commitment to sustainability and have implemented green practices into their brewing process, which is huge when you're thinking about the huge amount of water waste that usually goes into creating craft beer.
Right. And, you know, I think New Belgium also has some of that same history, right? They were an early craft beer pioneer. Same sustainability practices, but on the negative side of some of these breweries, Sierra Nevada, New Belgium specifically, a lot of people say they've lost touch, you know, with that small independent brewery feeling become too mainstream. And they've also been criticized for aggressive expansion and acquisition of other breweries. What do you have to say to that topic?
But it's so funny because like even one of the breweries that we're not really bringing up on this episode, it was like Stone. Stone was huge. We've talked about it on different lives and episodes where, yeah, you know, they went after smaller breweries for having Stone in their name. And sometimes not even smaller like companies. They went after macro companies like Keystone.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to watch. Stone said that they would never sell, and then they sold to a Japanese company. So that's interesting.
I forgot about that,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. But what's important to note with Sierra Nevada and New Belgium, they provided a lot of opportunities for growth and development. So while they are expanding aggressively, this growth and development of the craft beer industry, it's hard to say how much of that would be here without actions like this. They've also helped educate and raise awareness about craft beer to a wider audience. You know, like Miller Lite.
That's true, though. If you think
you're
about
right.
It.
Exactly.
They've literally expanded
to the water.
To the water audience,
which is a wider audience. You like that?
We're killing it, and we have some statistics later that prove that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
New Belgium has also had a very strong commitment to their community, and they have implemented employee ownership and profit sharing, which is
very interesting.
Yeah, we're going to have a whole episode on that type of ownership, because there's a couple breweries, at least five that I'm aware of, that are essentially employee owned.
Okay, what are they off the top of your head?
You have Harpoon, you have New Belgium. I think technically Tired Hands is in that list. I don't know if they've made the list that, of the one I was talking about, but they're on.
Yeah.
They're definitely considered on it after the whole debacle.
Ah, yes, the debacle that shall not be named. Also, we named it in many episodes before, so just go back and watch those. All right, and finally, let's discuss Boston Beer Company, or you know, mostly known for their Sam Adams brand.
Sammy right? Adams.
For, you know, your cousin from Boston. So the positive aspects of Boston Beer Company is that they've helped introduce a lot of people to craft beer. And I think they've pretty much been kind of credited with that craft beer push, being the originator, one of the very early originators that really expanded out and really pushed that different level of craft, if you will, into the mainstream. And that's kind of why they're heralded in that way, because they've been able to distribute and market their beer so well. And they also have a commitment to using high quality ingredients and traditional brewing methods.
Yeah, Jim Koch.
It could be all of the above.
Because like, I feel like that name is pronounced so many different ways depending on
who we're gonna go with Koch for this.
Koch. All right. Yeah, Jim Koch is definitely an interesting individual. The designer of our logo actually is a designer at Boston Beer Company now.
So they have their hands in everything.
Exactly. Yeah, they reached out to us. You know, that's what we're saying.
What we're saying is respond. We are not at all.
We got a cease and desist.
Yeah, it's gonna come right through the door as we're filming this.
Right, but Amy was one of those people that I wanted to bring on the episode on an episode a while back, and now even more so because through different conversations with her. You know, as she's worked there longer, she gets a better understanding of the company, and it would be really interesting to get her take on some of these positive and negatives. But they have a really strong philanthropic arm, right? They have this program called Samuel Adams Brewing the American Dream Program. There's no way I was going to remember that. I had to read it. Which helps small businesses, owners in the food, beverage, and hospitality industry.
Sure, yeah, and you know, once again, there's negatives with everything. I think when you talk about big companies, there's always going to be negatives in this capitalistic dog-eat-dog world that we live in. So, I'm trying to create the gravity, the gravitas for this
episode. I was
waiting
for you to start barking like DMX.
Where my beer's at? Brew with me now. Okay. So some of the negatives, though, of Boston Beer Company is, once again, size and ownership structure, kind of. You know, some people would say they're not a craft beer company anymore, although they certainly try to kind of market themselves as and kind of try to step into, rather keep that foot in the door, keep the door open for that kind of thing. So they've also been criticized for their heavy use of adjuncts, which would be like rice and corn in their beers instead of the good stuff.
So the water audience.
Yeah, exactly. They're reaching out to the water. What are you doing putting adjuncts in your beer?
What are you doing?
Yeah. We're on fire.
But I think, you know, again, when we're having this conversation, there are the negatives and there are the positives of each one of these companies. And I think that's why they remain so relevant. And will kind of always be have a household name until they do something like Tired Hands, right?
This is true.
But these powerhouses have really paved the way to what we see as the craft beer industry. When they were around, this was like, what? They were slowly creeping up when they first started opening to 1,000 brewing companies. You see, what was it, President Jimmy Carter, I think it was, who... Is he the one that got the home brewing legislation through?
I think it was Jimmy Carter.
Because it was illegal up until then. It certainly was happening, but it was illegal up until that point. And so you had under 1,000 brewery brewing companies. And then now we've, I think, expanded over that 9,000 mark. So without these guys...
Yeah, we wouldn't be where we are today. That's right. Certainly true. And it's definitely fair to say that they paved the way. But is it out with the old, in with the new? Find out all this and more as we continue on with the episode. So that's kind of the basic background of everything that we're going to kind of try to get into today and discuss. So what are your thoughts about the impact of these big names in early craft beer on the industry today?
I think what's nice, it's like, I think beer a lot of times, and you'll see it on the marketing, it's comparable to hip-hop.
All right.
Yeah, all ready right. for this hop? You ready for this hop take?
Oh, Jesus.
It's early on, you had these pockets, right? You had, like, the... And that's what these styles are known as, right? You had your West Coast-style IPAs. You had your New England's. You know, who are you looking at?
I'm breaking the fourth wall because we're all looking at you. Like, how are you going to wrap this one up? How are you bringing this one back around?
But you have all these pockets of areas, and for the most part, the distribution's not there. So unless you're there, you're not getting access to these okay. breweries. But you have all these...
No one is believing this.
Is it like how you had to have the cassettes for like...
Yeah, except it's like little bottles.
Right, right.
On the street corner passing bottles, it out.
Yeah.
You pass out your helmet on the corner.
There's a little mix and matches going now.
Well, mixtape.
Mixtapes, yeah. Taped together. Mix six tape together.
God. Okay. But I get that point, though. I think that's certainly... I feel like that's certainly something that can be said about a lot of things in terms of, like, in the beginning, it's very right. regional, especially back in the day before the internet age.
Right. And this is what we're seeing. So the way that we look at, like, a Sam Adams, a Sierra Nevada, like, all these other places, we're looking at blueprints of how to be successful. I think other brewing companies ended up being able to see, here we go with, like, some of these markets that are being a little more aggressive, Boston Beer Company being a hyper-aggressive company, buying Dogfish and whatever else that they can get their hands on to, right?
Right.
And being able to produce at such a high level. So it goes from, okay, cool, we are only in this little market, and we are this micro or this nano craft brewery, and we're doing it for the community, or it becomes like, well, everyone should have access to this, and we're just going to, like, ship it out. Because I think there is something to be said about Sam Adams versus Treehouse.
This is true.
Right.
But from a positive or negative standpoint, I guess, like, I think there's almost, craft beer is like the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And then as those got bigger, there was like an internal counterculture of exclusivity that kind of came out of it, where, you know, people appreciated, it's almost a traditionalistic sense at the end of the day as well, I guess, of like, we are regional and we're fighting the power of the macros. Excuse me. And now it's kind of flipped.
So now you see it more as like hip hop came into pop culture and is now on like Billboard 100, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So Drizzy Drake.
Well, first of all, he's not hip hop, so I don't know what you're talking about.
But Sam Adams isn't craft beer.
This is a fair
Sam
point.
Adams is the Drake of craft beer. You've heard it here first.
Why is this? All right, so now that we've lost all of our audience, at least in Canada, which I suppose isn't
Does
the
Canada
worst
even have craft beer?
Good question, Tyler. Does Canada have craft beer?
It does. I definitely have.
Another episode should be craft beer scenes internationally. Is it a thing?
That's true.
I feel like the American craft beer scene is a unique one, just because I feel like the traditional American big beer is kind of a very distinct thing, and I feel like internationally a lot of beer either isn't the thing at all and no one really cares culturally, or it's like a very old traditional thing that has a lot of pride in it when you talk about, like, you know, Germany or something like that. So I feel like the scenes are different, and I think that would be a cool topic of discussion at a later date to be had. Because I feel like these big anchors, you know, there's a point where you want to keep growing and surviving and sustaining, and you feel good about like your initial product to the point where you feel like you really want to push that. And I feel like it's hard to stay alive this long as one thing unless you take these measures to, you know, these business measures to buy up places, you know, expand your reach and try to really kind of keep a foothold in the market. Because if you want to, like I said, if you want to keep producing at that high level, you kind of need to buy up those assets in between and stomp down the competition.
Mash them.
Mash them. Oh, God. This is the dad joke episode as well. We didn't even know it.
Usually those are reserved to the six-pack episodes.
Yeah, so I wonder how the six-pack episode's going to be.
Which, do we plan that to be the sixth episode of the season?
We didn't plan that.
Just
it just kind of happened.
You did have some good planning.
Gotta give a shout out to the Amaryllis of the team.
Yeah.
She's a good manager.
She's a good Amaryllis.
Who never wants to be on the episode, but whose voice always makes it.
Always makes it.
On the past three episodes.
Okay, so that's kind of the historical sense. I'm wondering, is there anything else you could say about what you've seen in kind of how maybe these newer breweries are operating at the regional level that you think these older breweries might have had an impact on?
So there are two breweries in particular that stood out to me when we were, and I think really helped launch this episode to be what it was, and that's Voodoo Brewing Company and Iron Hill. Because that's one of those, at least regionally, we drive places or go places, and there's always an Iron Hill. For this region, always an Iron Hill.
Always.
Now, Voodoo, I actually didn't know the whole history behind them. I thought they were more Pittsburgh-based, but they're actually, like, I think it's Meadville or, like, Media.
Yeah, but that's, it's still that area. It's north, right. But it's still that area.
But it still had, I didn't realize how large of a reach they had until the last couple of years when I was looking at them. And then then, I thought it was like, oh, one or two here. Like, sort of like an other half sort of thing.
But as we're seeing, other half isn't even a one or two here.
Yeah, that's true. They're like nine. But
you know when someone says a pinch of salt, and then that pinch turns into...
So you're talking about Worst Cooks.
Yeah. Always bring back to Worst Cooks. I think it's perfect. It's a perfect analogy for everything.
Worst Cooks is the perfect analogy for everything. Shout out to Carla.
Nothing like a 15-year-old reference considered when that aired, but...
It's all about discovery, much like craft beer. It's all about when you discover something. Pseudo-Sue might be the best thing in the world when you first discover it.
I still think it's up. I still think Pseudo-Sue holds up. I will fight people to the dying death on that one. As a pale ale, can't go wrong with Pseudo-Sue.
Mm. But Voodoo has about 15 locations now throughout the whole U.S. Iron Hill is a regional one. So when I'm thinking about new models that we see, I am thinking about how do you expand without becoming somebody that purchases everybody and like becomes too big. So they have ownership and they offer sort of, I think they go on a mainstream scale, but in the same way that like maybe like a McDonald's franchise would do it, right? So like you're a franchise owner of it, I think is how that operates.
Right. They basically are just in the market for franchisees.
Right. Hey, you want to open this? Yeah. We got this. Versus like, hey, we want to buy you.
Right. We're opening up a location owned and operated by us instead.
So I think that creates like a new door that wasn't quite open yet. Like the template was there, but no one had the key to like just like, okay, what happens if we just...
Do you think that's a good thing?
I think that remains to be seen.
I agree. I don't know enough. So before we move on, I just want to hit some terms, some definitions real quick so that everyone can understand kind of what we're talking about in terms of sizing breweries. Because we think, what is a craft brewery, right? What's a microbrewery? What's a macro brewery? We don't know. Yes, we do. We have some definitions. So, first of all, we talk about production, right? Mm-hmm. In volume. We have the U.S. beer barrel. Barrel is a volume unit. It's 31 gallons, okay, for our purposes here.
Per barrel.
Yes.
Right.
So, each barrel is 31 gallons, U.S. gallons, for all you international folks. So a microbrewery produces less than 15,000 barrels per year, and that equates to about 465,000 gallons of beer per year. But also, they have to sell 75% or more of that off-site. If they sell more of that on-site, then it's either considered a taproom brewery or a brew pub if they have food services.
Unless you're New Jersey.
Yeah, or if you're New Jersey, just fuck you then. Fuck you, we're going back to the 20s.
They might as well make, like, brewing illegal in New Jersey at this point.
Well, hold on a second.
Next episode.
Okay, next episode, I have some theories. Just remind me theories, because this is great for a six-pack episode. So that's a micro. All that's considered micro. So basically, low production and low reach,
okay,
per se. Then you have a regional brewery, which is the next step up. Regional brewery is going to be over that 15,000 barrel mark, but it's going to be under 6 million barrels, which 6 million is about 186 million gallons of beer per year. If you're under that, you're regional. If you're above that, that's where you get into your macros. And from what I've seen, craft brewery just means you aren't a macro. If you're not a macro brewery, then you're a craft.
Because every year, Yingling,
is considered craft.
America's oldest brewery.
Because they don't produce 6 million barrels a year. By definition, they are not a macro brewery.
But I would argue, well, neither is Sam Adams, which we'll come into that conversation again.
But Sam Adams
is more craft than Yingling.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Anyway.
But what does craft mean, Tyler? We've discussed that on a live. Go check it out. So I kind of want to then transition into this next discussion point about public perception. What role have these early craft breweries played in shaping the public perception and consumer demand for craft beer?
I think what helped, where these anchors have helped craft beer like start from, it's like I'll even throw Blue Moon into this conversation, right?
Okay.
Whereas you start to talk to someone who doesn't know a lot about craft beer, but wants to kind of get into it. I was like, well, what do you like? And it's usually, well, I like a Blue Moon.
I feel like that's fairly common.
Right. And it's just like, when you start to see people start to get into craft beer, a lot of times it's like, oh, I really like Sierra Nevada's, like, stuff. Or I really like the Boston Lager. You know,
it's a good stepping stone.
They have created that stepping stone. And I think what helped was the stepping stone wasn't... It was no longer Miller Lite to Pliny the Elder.
So just more accessible. You got this little middle ground here where you could take that step.
You could go Miller Lite, Blue Moon, Sierra Nevada.
You didn't need mountain climbing equipment to reach the next level.
About Coors Light?
Shut up. Oh no, that's a fair point. Actually, I would agree with that. I think accessibility of a product that isn't just your standard, because the difference between a Miller to a Budweiser to a Coors, it's not that big at the end of the day. And you might prefer one over the other for very small differences in the grand scheme of things. But to see these other breweries, even like Boston Lager, which it's a lager. It's not like a pale ale, which is kind of different, especially when you're talking about like Sierra Nevada's pale ale or even Fat Tire from New Belgium. Mm-hmm. Like these are kind of the difference between them and the macro beers is completely bigger than the differences that all the macro beers have, like that range. You know what I mean? It's kind of like how we're closer to Cleopatra in years, in distance of years, than she was to, like, when the pyramids were built. Mm-hmm. Even though we think that's such a long time, it's right. Like we're talking about scales of difference here.
Right.
So I feel like just having that publicly available and readily available really is important in terms of getting more people to buy into different types of beers, just understanding. So sometimes it might be a little mind-boggling for people like us to go into any beer or brew pub or any bar and just be like, ah, Sierra Nevada, Fat Tire, Stone IPA, that's all you got. But at the end of the day, like, that's a good overall, a good round representation of different types of beer.
Yeah, well, I think you had said something that kind of sparked something in me with the how do then these larger scale breweries help gain interest, right? And this next one that I'm going to bring up is no way to the same caliber as, not even caliber, but status as like Boston Beer Company, but Trogs, right? Trogs, I think, has a really cool hold on the craft beer community because, one, kind of said, like, centrally kind of located in PA. So if you're someone that's getting the craft beer in PA, Trogs is readily available. They have a bunch of different styles that's right there, and they've made it kind of like fun too with like the different releases that they have.
Right.
But very much different than going to like a Love City Brewing Company, right? In terms of scale and just like
that's
what
true,
they're able
yeah.
to do.
Yeah, in terms of scale.
However, what's nice about it too is they invite you in to learn about the process. Everything that's built around it is about educating the consumer. So
that's
even
true.
Their artwork on the walls and stuff like that, it's just like, these are the hops we use. This is the flavor profiles that you should be getting. This is the perceived bitterness. By the way, take a self-guided tour through our brewery. See what it's like. See what we do differently, but what most people do as well.
Right.
And learn about this process.
And also, they have their little, like, research and development lab right there too, right, that you can look into and see how the science behind it goes. So that's a really good point. I think once again, when we're talking about scale mostly, but even smaller scale breweries can still have this type of impact, at least in a regional
right standpoint. And in New Jersey you have to do a tour.
That's right, you have to do a tour and put your name on the list. It's like it's like you're getting credits for something.
We're talking about this next episode. I just can't help but bring up New Jersey every time. It's so bad.
It's crazy.
And then to like go into the consumer demand for the craft beer, it's something mm-hmm. that you and I harp on over and over again, and I think it's worth bringing up over and over again. It's the, are people going to stand in line for, it used to be Treehouse. It used to be like, some of those other, like Trillium, you know, these breweries where it was harder to get access to. You had to stay in line.
Right.
You only were able to take out X amount of beer.
Very exclusive.
We saw other halves starting to ship to PA and then actually be sold in PA and then open up in PA. We see Trillium now being able to be shipped to PA. I think you can get like four packs a year in terms of shipping is concerned.
We're
seeing this access become different. While earlier on, it was that consumer demand made these places exciting and new and, like, exclusive.
Right, they didn't have to expand. That
and
wasn't
now,
competition.
That kind of, like, pendulum swifting back to, like, inclusive.
Right, so it's almost like if you don't want to, if you're a big company, I guess maybe their thought process is, our way of having to reach out to the consumer is by our business expanding. Which means buying up places that have regional influence.
This yin and yang thing is really interesting, though, because like, what is
Iron
Hill?
It's called Ying Ling. Sorry, what were you saying?
So, like, what Iron Hill does really well is they have specific beers based off their locations, too, right? They have
their
regular available ones, but they brew at every single one of their locations. And so they have stuff that is this is like Philly specific, right? So like Phoenixville had like award winning ones, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like the Phoenixville Iron Hill award winning beer isn't an Iron Hill award winning beer. It's a Phoenixville Iron Hill award winning beer.
So in that, it's almost like a...
So they're inclusive in the sense of, you know our name.
Right.
But it's exclusive in terms of, I will venture into an Iron Hill if I'm, like, on the low end of, like, okay, I've checked everything else out. On the understanding that they're going to have something that I can't get at somewhere else. And they do that with Sam Adams, too, based off of the different locations.
Okay.
Might be something that's, like, more readily available. Or, for instance, they'll be, like... This is only available in the Boston area or the Boston Tap Room. Like, you can get your Oktoberfest everywhere, but you might not be able to get, like, one of these draft beers.
True. That's
in California, even though it's available.
That's a fair point. I think, you know, you need to be big enough and have kind of enough infrastructure and capital to be able to do something like that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of places that have multiple locations might only brew at one or two of them, and then they just shipped everything else. So
other half.
Right. And, you know, early on, I thought Other Half was just, like, losing beer on their way down to D.C. from New York. And it just kind of fell off the truck in Pennsylvania.
Right.
That's how we were getting
it. They were getting, like, robbed.
Yeah, they were getting robbed by Pennsylvania distributors. Like,
D.C.'s like, what the fuck is going on?
It's like they're paying taxes in cases of beer instead of tolls coming across the bridge into Philly.
It's just like a cow of like cow. What is a herd of cows?
A herd.
I've done one beer.
All right.
I've done one beer.
You're so close, guys.
We're so close.
A herd of deer. Herd of beer.
Well, isn't there a gaggle of something?
Goose.
Gaggle of goose.
Geese.
Is that a thing? And there's a murder of crows. Anyway, on that discussion of kind of infrastructure and capital and means, I kind of wanted to get into the discussion of, you know, business practices and strategies that these early craft breweries have had impact on that, on the industry in terms of innovation and competition, because my thought process is, you know, there are negatives, obviously, as we discussed, in terms of maybe them trying to keep the competition or what they perceive as a competition down instead of being a little more inclusive in some cases, or just kind of being more being more corporate than they are craft, you know, for the love of it versus, you know, profit. But, you know, there's something to be said about the environmental impacts that, you know, small breweries can't really... They don't have the money to invest in the research and development aspect of getting the brewery systems at that level to such a point where they're reducing their waste completely or coming up with new technologies that would increase production efficiency, you know, decrease waste, whether it's water waste, grain waste, that type of stuff. And I feel like that's where these anchors, these big anchors who have been around forever, who have the infrastructure, I feel like that's where they can really impact the industry in a positive way to keep mm-hmm. it sustainable. So I think that's the area that I'd like to see
yeah.
everyone at that level go further into.
I think what you're saying is like a really good point. It's the... people that have the luxury to pioneer in these areas and do it not just to be like in an exclusive way, we're just like, okay, we're going to hold the secret to how we like produce no waste, right? But rather become like, here's the new like gold standard of how you can do this in a way that doesn't take away from the quality of the beer. We have the time to do the research and development. We have the technology to put into best practice. Yeah, it was form-fitted for us, but now we're going to help like other breweries
right.
go forward, because what we see with the breweries that we have access to, that we have been able to interact with on a closer like person-to-person scale, is it's not about brewery A and brewery B competing against each other and like Bob's Burgers and Jimmy Pesto. right? Yes. Where they're just like, they don't want to see anybody, like, the other person succeed.
Right, it's not that. I feel like at least at the micro level, it's never been that. But again, that's because I think they kind of need to lean on each other. And we've discussed before how they
But that's
do that.
Where I think the anchors should be living in. Like, that's the avenue that they should be operating out of. It's like, okay, cool, the big issue is there's a shit ton of water waste, right?
Right.
How do we make a common practice? Like, how do we work with the Brewers Association and the different guilds to be like, here's what we need to do in order for that to work? We have a big enough name that we have, like, sway over Congress, legislation, because they know how much that we bring in to this economy and, like, how we can affect on a political scale to put more investment into these different areas and to make it easier and more affordable to do that stuff rather than pinching the little guy.
Yeah, because like I think from my background in a standpoint of things, I think, you know, the environmental impacts are extremely important. Sustainability is important. And the issue, though, is that anything that is just solely an environmental thing that's good for the environment but not necessarily good for production, you know, whether it's adding more equipment on to make something more environmentally friendly, like that's coming off the bottom line at the end of the day. And I think, you know, it's difficult to fight that without types of legislation, but also, you know,
that's where that, I guess, tax incentives and everything come from.
You need stuff like that. Excuse me. But I really think that's where we kind of should live, even as consumers. We should really just think of these, you know, hey, they were pioneers. They were once the innovators. They were once the leaders when it came to types of beer and creating this delicious beer that's unique, right? And then they became the pioneers of creating that beer and also being able to replicate that for on a large scale. And it's always going to be the same. Now I think it should be turned to, I think more of their efforts should be turned to, hey, you know what? Maybe we don't need to be the innovators of the craft anymore in terms of the product. Now we need to be the innovators of making sure this is sustainable forever. And I think they can be the pioneers on the production side and the back end side. And I think they are in some cases, but to be, you know, to lead that charge in being, making things more efficient, more sustainable, and working with those smaller brewers then to be able to scale that down to what they're doing. Because, you know, a lot of these microbreweries, they cannot withstand attempting to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's got to be something. They can't just go out on a limb and research R&D it to death. You know, they can't do that. They don't have the money and the time to do that. They barely get enough production done on their own. And so it's up to these big guys to do that. And I think we should be okay as consumers with that being their role and not pushing them to be something that they're not anymore, while still acknowledging that they, you know, that they've helped create this big thing that we love, and it's okay that they aren't innovating the next triple hopped beer anymore, you know? And that's all I have to say about that. Cheers. I didn't get passionate, you got passionate.
Hey, I like it. I like when you get on these soliloquies.
Soliloquize.
I'm a real life. I guess last question, I think, are these anchors morally obligated to continue to innovate or evolve for the sake of the craft? Like, it's very similar to what we were just discussing, but do you think that, like, obligation exists? Do you think that, like, what does the future look like as breweries get bigger?
Yeah, I think going back to what I was just saying, I think we, morally, they don't have to kind of continue to develop the craft in terms of mashing all these, remember, creating hops and mashing all these hop combinations together or creating this weird sour beer. Like,
oh, yeah.
We should be okay with them continuing the production end side of things and kind of getting into that because they have the capital and the money to do it. And I think there's plenty of hands in the pot when it comes to crafting weird, innovative beers. And we shouldn't have it as a knock on these big ones to do that because they're big companies, they have this. They have stuff like this, like employee-owned profit sharing stuff. They can do stuff like that. They can expand. They have amenities and opportunities for people to get into the industry, and they can actually pay living wages for those things because they have the money to do so.
So it becomes less of the, I'm looking for this brewery to put out something new all the time, versus I'm looking for this brewery to do something revolutionary.
Ooh.
Right.
Gravitas.
Because I think that it becomes like flipped again then onto the consumer, like what that consumer demand is. I think currently we exist in a, I want something new, I want something that's never been done. And, you know, that's where I think we pigeonhole some of these bigger guys sometimes, where we're like, well, we want to see this. But at the same time, we want to see more diversity. We want to see more ways of inclusion. But we also want to, we have this climate like activism that's going on as well. We want to see this done in a more sustainable way as well, because climate issues are race issues too. Because who gets hurt by this type of stuff, right?
Right. The people with less access to resources. So
it's all, and that's the point of the show in a whole is, on the surface level of this, it may not seem like, oh, they're just talking about beer. But there's a lot of things that are happening within beer that impacts us, right? Like, who's being employed? What are these opportunities? What are the business opportunities? How does Harris Family or, like, two locals get a foothold into an industry? You know, they're talking about an industry that has this rapid growth, but you only see ownership as 1% of this pie that was once under 1,000 and then skyrocketed to like over 9,000 companies. That's only 1% ownership.
Right. It's wild. And once again, you know, I think these big companies that have the departments in place, to make these, to be focused on these types of things. And you kind of seen that with Sam Adams when we were at
Barrel and Flow.
I was about to say Fresh, but Barrel and Flow, where they are collaborating and there is an arm that's, you know, working towards that. There is at least an arm of that. And I think that's where you have to, you know, if you have, they have the capital, they have the opportunity. That's where I think we should be looking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can save the everlasting search for the best craft beer to the small guys,
yeah,
and kind of allow these bigger companies to do this type of work while still putting out, you know, the consistent beer that's gotten them to this point. So.
I think that's a perfect way to wrap up this episode. It's like everything, you're going to have the pioneers that start off and you're just going to see everybody get better and better as history moves forward. That's just how it should work. And so we're just trying to open up the dialogue or... All right, so for those listening and got this far, mea culpa, I messed up. I forgot equipment because I am scatterbrained.
Let's get the podium out in front of you. I'm deeply appalled and ashamed.
Yeah, seriously. I was even asked, do you have all the stuff for the episode? I was like, yeah, of course I do. Yeah, I did it. So we're doing this right off the camera audio, and I looked away from the camera for a little too long, and it sucked recording.
Yeah, you look away from the camera for half a second, and it just completely ruins everything.
But the basis of this episode was like looking at these innovators not to be gatekeepers anymore. And just to create more opportunities for what you said, if it made the cut, for the smaller breweries to become the next great brewery, the next great beer. That's what we're really looking for.
We walked so you all can run.
Right.
So we're going to let you guys run as we continue to kind of lay the foundation.
Exactly. So this was the anchors of craft craft beer.
Yes.
Make sure that you are following us on Instagram at The Alternative Blacks Pod. Subscribe to our Patreon if you want to support us, but also just listening to the episodes is a good way of supporting us. Every time you listen to an episode through Anchor, we earn some money through the ad that plays in the beginning of it, so you can support us just by listening. So subscribe, rate us, you know, share this with whoever you want. We love you guys, and until next time,
peace.